is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 45th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today Lori Craner. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Lori Craner is an associate professor of computer science and engineering and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University, as well as director of Scilab Usable Privacy and Security Lab. She's also chief scientist of Wombat Security Technologies. She's a well-known privacy and security researcher with over 80 research papers and the books Security and Usability and Web Privacy with P3P. Lori served on the board of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and was a researcher at AT&T Labs for several years before she became an academic. Dr. Craner's PhD is in engineering and policy from Washington University in St. Louis. She lives in Pittsburgh with her husband Chuck and three children, plays the sax, and creates quilts. Howdy, Lori.
Hi.
So let's start out with a really easy one. What do normal everyday people, unlike us, think privacy is?
What do normal people think privacy is? Well, people have a lot of different views about privacy, and it's actually not something that they think about that much. I've had a lot of conversations with normal everyday people, and you know, you ask them, what do you think about privacy? What are your privacy preferences? And they kind of stop, and they don't really know. But I think the first sort of responses you get back have more to do with security than privacy. People talk about not wanting to have their identity stolen, not wanting hackers to steal their stuff like that. And then when they reflect on it more, then there's also this notion of, I have information that's none of your business, and I want to keep it private. I also tried asking my kids what they think of privacy.
Oh, that's interesting. What do they say?
Well, so I asked my son when he was about 5 years old, and he thought about it, and he says, it's about being alone. And I thought that was a pretty good definition.
Yeah, that's where you want privacy when you go to the bathroom.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, back to the other kind of privacy. Do you think that people have an intrinsic care about privacy when you get them to think about it? And what do you have to do to get people to explicitly recognize this privacy thing?
So I think most people actually do care a lot about privacy, they don't articulate it, but I think they all have these privacy needs and desires, and when they feel like their privacy is being invaded, they speak up and they let you know. It's not difficult to get them to speak up when you give them examples. One of my students recently did a study on behavioral advertising, and she started the interview by just showing people printouts of web pages that had ads on them. Mm-hmm. And she didn't say anything about privacy. She just said, look at this web page. Where are the ads? What do you think about these ads? What do you think's going on? And people spontaneously started talking about the fact that they thought ads invaded their privacy.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. I had a roommate in college who used to like to track who was using his name for various mailing lists by changing his middle initial. And then he would do crazy things like join the ACLU and the NRA and watch how the things intersected. But it seems like that, it's much easier than ever before to track information about who believes what just by tracking behavior on the internet. And
yeah,
it seems that most people don't understand that. Is there something we can do about that?
Yeah, I think it's true that people don't really understand. They're really unaware of the kind of tracking that goes on, and that's one of the things that we've been looking at in our research at Carnegie Mellon is how can we raise this awareness. And so we've been looking at, well, can we take privacy policies and make them into something that's actually useful instead of 10 pages of legalese?
Right.
Can we build basically user agent tools that you'd have in your web browser or in your social networks that would help you understand the privacy implications of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you were kind of going where I wanted to ask next, which is, in the U.S., most large corporations kind of play lip service to privacy with some sort of inscrutable policy statement buried on a website, or maybe some horrible HIPAA flyer that you can't read because the print's too small if you're over 40. And so that seems it seems that the corporations believe they can check off the privacy concerns of people by these lip service maneuvers. Do you think that they are guilty about that, or do you think that they just want to sweep the thing under the rug? What's to be done about this problem?
So different corporations, I think, have different motivations for what they do.
Do you know a good one? Maybe you could give us an example of somebody doing it right.
Well, so I think there are some of them that are trying to do it right. I don't think there are very many, if any, who are succeeding. But, you know, there's some companies that I think, you know, deservedly, you know, we think of as kind of evil companies, but there are others that I've talked to their chief privacy officers and their privacy staff, and they actually seem to actually want to do the right thing and want to communicate, and they're trying. But, you know, the lawyers can't help themselves. You know, this is the way they've been trained to write.
Right.
You know, I talked to one who told me that her goal is to make privacy policies that sound chatty. And I was like, wow, chatty. That seems very different than what we've read.
I don't know if that would work, but
I'm not sure.
Can you think of a particular example of a corporation that you think is doing a good job? Because there are so many that are doing a bad job. That would be easy.
Yeah. So I can't say that I've read a privacy policy from a big corporation that I would say really kind of hits the mark of communicating with consumers. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, there are some companies that are now supplementing their full privacy policy with something else. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, Google has released a number of short videos about different aspects of their privacy policy. And these are actually pretty nice. They're pretty clear, and they explain to you for a specific aspect of their system, you know, search engines or use of cookies or things like that, you know, exactly why they do what they do and what it means to you.
Interesting.
I think that's a step in the right direction.
So I know you're working on a project through CUPS that is purporting to create nutrition labels for privacy. You want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So we started thinking about, you know, what can we do to make privacy policies better? And we did a lot of testing of some of the ones that are out there to see how consumers, you know, dealt with them. And what we found is that even the ones that we viewed as the best, you know, we looked at some and for example, the privacy policy for O'Reilly. Mm-hmm. That one seems a bit better to us than a lot of the others. And we looked at the reading score. It tells you like what grade level reading level, and that was a little bit better than some of the others. But we tested these with consumers, and pretty much universally they were hated.
So even the hippies can't do it right.
Yeah. They were all hated. People hated having to read them, and we asked them reading comprehension questions, and people just couldn't answer them.
Right.
You know, the very basic ones, does this website use a cookie? Okay, that one people could usually figure out. But then we asked them, you know, is this website going to use your information for marketing? Are they going to sell it to other companies? And people just couldn't figure it out from the policies. So we started looking at, well, how do we communicate with consumers in other contexts? And we hit on this nutrition label idea. And you know, the idea with a nutrition label is that you have a standard format that every food product you look at has the information in the same format.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can look at it at a glance and compare two products. You can put two cereal boxes side by side. And you can also, you don't have to read the whole thing. You can decide what's important to you. So you know, one person is worried about cholesterol and another person is worried about calories. And you know, you can find the part that you care about. And so we said, well, can we do the same thing for privacy? And so that's what we've been trying to do. We've been trying to distill these complicated privacy policies into a standard tabular format.
That sounds pretty cool. Which federal agency is the one responsible for the nutrition labels? Is that the FDA?
I think so.
But aren't those the same guys who put the like tiny little print in your drugs? that you give the pharmacy?
Yeah, well, they're working on drug fact labels as well to try to standardize that. You know, I don't think that you can say that nutrition labels or drug fact labels or Energy Star labels or any of these things are, you know, 100% like perfect solve the problem as far as communicating with consumers. But they do get us a lot closer than a 10-page, you know, privacy policy full of legalese.
Do you think that those sorts of things that are statements about one individual site is going to do are better than maybe public service announcements that tell people what actually happens with their data?
Well, I think we need both. One of the things that we've also observed is that, you know, privacy has its own jargon, and there are a lot of things that if you don't understand how data flows, then even if you have a very simple privacy policy to read, it won't necessarily make sense because you're not understanding what a third-party data transfer is and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing goes with nutrition labels. There's a lot of nutritional jargon on there, and if you don't know what cholesterol is or what the good kind or the bad kind is, you know, it may not make a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And so these things have to be accompanied by the educational campaigns or the glossaries or whatnot to help people understand what this all means.
Mm-hmm. So here's a philosophical question for you. What is the relationship between trust and privacy?
Well, there's a lot of relationships, actually. So the kind of the cynical view is that the whole deal with privacy policies is you have to trust the companies to actually do what they say, and so privacy policies are all about trust. And I think actually privacy and trust are very much kind of intertwined concepts, and companies are motivated to talk about privacy because they want to build trust with their consumers. But we hope that underlying it all, there's more than just trust that this is going on. That there's some way of verifying and knowing for sure that they really are doing what they say, and it's not just a trust us sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. So you sort of need an underwriter's lab for privacy, I suppose.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Gary McGraw, host of the Reality Check podcast with Gary McGraw. This podcast series is focused on practical questions centered on running large-scale software security initiatives. Reality Check targets experienced leaders working to solve software security problems every day. Reality Check is sponsored by Sigital and syndicated by CSO Magazine. For more, see www.sigital.com/realitycheck. So, governments in the world seem to have divergent approaches to privacy. In the BSIM Europe study that we just did, we noted that EU software security initiatives actually pay attention to privacy, as, you know, contrasted with their US initiatives, because the EU has privacy laws and regulations. So why is the US lagging so far behind the EU?
Well, I guess traditionally we've had a very different legislative approach to privacy, part of it may be historical, and part of it is just not just privacy, but the way we deal with legislation on a lot of different things in the U.S. That we have this very decentralized approach where we don't have a lot of laws that are kind of overarching, but you know there are things that are left for state laws. We have very sector specific legislation in a lot of areas. Privacy legislation in the U.S. has kind of followed that pattern. Now, that said, it doesn't have to be that way. We certainly could have the kind of overarching privacy laws that you see in Europe. There are a lot of people who are arguing that that's what we should have. Mm-hmm. I think, 10 years ago, there was just vehement opposition to that sort of thing in the U.S., especially among industry. I think now the tide is starting to shift, and there seems to be more of an openness towards having stronger privacy legislation in the U.S., and so we may get there eventually. We'll see.
But you think it's a reasonable approach?
The European approach?
Yeah.
I think in general it is a reasonable approach.
So kind of speaking about the difference that 10 years can make, and I found the Patriot Act kind of an affront to individual liberty. That was something done in the name of security when everybody was scared because of terrorist attacks. Do you think that there are better tools that lawmakers can use to ensure security without impinging on liberty and privacy of its citizens?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there was a big scramble in the wake of 9/11 to try to do something to make people feel safe. And I think a lot of the things that were done maybe help people feel safe, but it's not entirely clear that they actually made people any safer.
Mm-hmm.
It's often posed as well. Do you want privacy or do you want security? You can't have both. You know, choose what you want.
Right.
But in many cases, it's not clear that we actually got security. So we lost privacy, and it's not clear we had a big security benefit.
Right. So how are we supposed to get to the bottom of that trade-off and what actually happened?
I don't know. I don't have all the answers here. I think it's particularly frustrating because when you talk about matters of national security, it's hard to even have the debate, because when you start down the debate, you're told, oh, wait, we can't discuss this. You know, there's stuff, if you knew what we knew, but we can't tell you what we know. And so how do you have a debate about that?
You know, we tried to have a panel at RSA last year about surveillance and ask the government to participate, which they did, and they sent a guy who's a really great guy in person, but who sort of lapsed into privacy law speak of the sort we were talking about before during his discussion, and everybody fell asleep during that part. So I guess the lawyers are a problem when it comes to that stuff too.
Yeah.
So getting away from lawyers, I guess we can move to what some of us affectionately call the privacy duck. although I don't think it's a duck, but I wanted to ask what impact the Platform for Privacy Preferences Project, or P3P, to say it more easily, had on the evolution of the web and thinking about privacy.
Okay. So we call it Privacy Bird, but it does look like a duck.
We say the privacy duck quacks again.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. So P3P, I think we started working on P3P back in 1996, and I think it was an idea that was kind of ahead of its time. We came in with the notion that we would have an XML representation of a privacy policy, and then your browser could read it automatically and do something useful for you. The very early views of P3P were actually that your browser could negotiate about privacy for you.
Wow.
Although that got dropped because that was just unworkable.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a pretty straightforward concept, but it actually took us about 5 years to figure out what are the ideas about privacy that should even be encoded in XML in the first place. And then there were issues with, where do you put this chunk of XML on your website, and how do you know which part it applies to, and what about cookies, and what about third-party cookies, and what do you do so that we can send these privacy policies around without actually slowing down browsing. And so it actually ended up taking 5 years, and we finally got the P3P specification out through the W3C, and Microsoft built some P3P support into the IE6 web browser.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still there in IE7 and IE8. But most of the world is pretty much unaware of this going on. When I give talks about privacy, sometimes I show people the P3P features in IE, and I ask for a show of hands of how many people knew that this was there.
Yeah, right. It's the problem with the rest of Microsoft software. There's so much crap in there. Who knows what's in there?
Yeah, exactly. So it is kind of the best kept secret in IE, I've had many people who have said, oh, P3P, that's dead. And you know, and I was like, no, I can assure you, it's not dead. It's alive and well. No, it never did catch on as much as we had hoped. But there are a lot of companies that have adopted it. If you look at you know, the top companies on the web, about a third of them, if you say the top 100, about a third of them have actually adopted it. And there are new ones that are adopting it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of P3P, some of them are actually improving their privacy policies.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. So, you know, this is always the problem with privacy stuff. Either it's that, you know, crazy inscrutable law or when we build the right tools, it's hard to get people to adopt them. So that's why I asked the thing before about public service announcements and trying to get people to just generally be aware that there's this thing called privacy that doesn't involve just being private when you're going to the bathroom.
Right.
So I don't know, maybe kindergarten should start teaching people the different view of privacy. Who knows?
Yeah, no, it's been suggested that we need a privacy education module, you know, for elementary schools.
That might not be a bad idea. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
So, speaking of educating people, I got a question for you that I always ask women who I interview for Silver Bullet, and that is, why are there so few women in computing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I knew. I think for whatever reason, computing has not been a field that appeals to women. And I must say that how I got into computing was almost accidental. I had been exposed to computing from an early age because my father had used computers. And you know, when I was in first grade, I used to go into his office when we had no school days, and you know, program BASIC on his PDP-11. And,
mm-hmm.
I was this geeky kid, from the start, and actually took computer science in high school and took the AP exam, and never really liked it very much, and especially because to do the computer science homework, we'd have to go into the computer lab after school, and the environment in the computer lab was just, you know, this uber geek environment, which just totally turned me off. I was like, you know, the only girl sitting in the computer lab with all these like guys who were just, you know, way beyond geeky as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, ooh.
and I was like, you know, the great thing about this AP exam is I'm going to take it, I'm going to pass, and I'm never going to have to take another computer science class in my life. And then I went on to college, and at my college they said, well, your AP scores don't actually get you out of computer science. It just means you get to take the more advanced class.
Good for that. Good for that school. What school was that?
That was Washington University in St. Louis.
So you went there undergrad too?
Yeah, I was there undergrad as well. So so I found myself, unfortunately, at the time, you know, having to take computer science even though I didn't want to. And then after I'd taken a few courses, they were like, oh, you take one more class and you could have a minor in computer science. So I was like, I've come this far, let's do that. I said, okay, well, I'm done with that. I'm going on to do my graduate degree in engineering and public policy. But somewhere along the way, I ended up taking some more computer science classes because I was doing internet policy stuff, and then I ended up doing a master's degree in computer science, and then someday I found myself as a computer science professor, and I just don't quite know how it happened.
So what advice, other than following your nose, would you give to a young woman interested in pursuing a CS career today?
Well, so I think... the important thing is to, you know, first of all, look beyond the geekiness of it all, but also to realize that computer science is a very broad field, and I think a lot of young people look at computer science as just, you know, sitting in front of a computer and programming all day, and there are certainly a lot of people who do that and enjoy doing that, but there's also a lot more to it than that, and you can be a computer scientist and spend very little of your time actually programming as part of your career. That there are human computer interaction issues. There are sort of the mathematical foundations of computer science. There's so many different aspects of computer science that go beyond just sitting in front of a terminal and programming. So I think young people need to be aware of that when they're thinking about their careers.
I agree with you. I mean, I think it's particularly important that we emphasize the breadth of the field, because computers are working their way into everything. And when people who don't really understand these things that we've built set public policy, we can find ourselves in pretty serious trouble as a society.
Yeah.
So, you know, having people like you helping policymakers make good decisions is a really important thing. Last question. So musically, you've moved from piccolo to flute to alto to tenor. So what's next, bassoon or baritone?
That's a good question. at this point, I don't seem to have time to play much of anything.
So you're stuck on tenor for a while.
Stuck on tenor for a while. That's about all I can handle right now. But someday, we'll see.
Well, good luck getting back to it. I know having young kids is always a challenge. Thanks for your time, Lori.
Thank you very much.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The November-December 2009 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy is a special issue devoted to insider threats. The issue also includes a feature on trusted computing by Bruce Potter. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.